this morning?
Good morning. Would have been nervous.
Okay. So what is your name, sir?
The Olivera, 92679.
Okay, so Mr. Mueller is going to be conducting the hearing this morning. His voice will be the next voice that you would hear. And just give me one moment, sir. So we concluded your father's hearing, and the board, the Department of Correction has certified him within 6 months to come back before this board, and then they'll send out those notifications again. In the meantime, during that period of time, we're going to try to get some definition of legally of what we can do with the deportation and the home arrest. Okay?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. So that's it. Okay, you're welcome. Okay, Mr. Mill.
Okay, Mr. Dio, how do you pronounce your name again?
D. Olivera.
Okay, D. Olivera. There was a couple of letters in there that I wondered about pronunciation, but it's just D. Olivera. Okay, sir. So would you state your full name and the agency number for the record, please?
John Octavio D. Olivera.
And your agency number, sir?
92679.
Okay, you're appearing before the Oregon Board of Executive Clinic this morning in reference to a parole hearing. I'm going to introduce the board members that conduct the hearing at this time. And on your screen to your far left is the Honorable Bill Rittenhouse. We have the Honorable Michael Johnson, who is the acting board chair. All the way to the right is the Honorable Liz Monis. My name is David Neal, and I'll be the hearing lead. I'll explain, if you see me looking off to my left shoulder, that we have a TV screen right in front of us that is kind of blurry sometimes, and the one to my left is a little bit more clear. So it just dawned on me that if I'm looking over there, it's kind of a weird situation. So anyway, first off, I'm going to tell you that you have some supporters in the boardroom for you today. And we'll certainly through this hearing, and then if they wish to speak, they'll have an opportunity to address the board. Okay, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I'm going to give some information about your case, your sentences, and, the circumstance of the offense. As I go through it, if you hear something that you don't think is correct, let me know, and we'll discuss it and figure it out. The information I have comes from several different sources, and it's what they put in front of us, so that's what we rely on the majority of the time. And sometimes it's inaccurate. And as far as major inaccuracies, if it is really something serious, we'll get into a point where we can really discuss it in depth, okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay, now I have a question for you before we go any further. According to the paperwork we have, there is an ICE detainer. Are you a citizen of another country?
Yes, sir. I was born in Portugal.
Portugal, you say?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so, all right, that's, it didn't list your country of origin or anything like that, just said that you're, there's an ICE detainer. And our last hearing, there was a detainer situation came up. So, you're 55 years old now, sir?
Going on 58 this year.
Okay. That, there again, I think I took that information out at the top of the AIMS printout, and that's, and of course, sometimes my glasses aren't straight, so. All right, you're serving a life sentence for reckless manslaughter, and that began on June 11, 1991. You were convicted by a jury after withdrawing a plea agreement. You were, at the time of the incident, of the offense, you were a probation absconder from the state of Massachusetts. And apparently there were other pending charges besides just the probation that was going on in Massachusetts at that time. You also had one prior felony conviction, a historical conviction. You were sentenced on July 17, 1992. You appealed the conviction and sentence, and they were both affirmed or upheld by the appeals court. You became board eligible on November 27th of 2016, and were certified for this hearing, which is for right appeal, or absolute discharge on April 23rd, 2019. You also have, as we discussed, you have an ICE detainer, and this is your fourth time before the board. So I'm going to go over the basics of the offense at this time, and like I said, this is based on the pre-sentence report, and also there is some information. We do have a letter from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office in opposition to any type of release. It's dated April 9th, 2019, and some of the information is moving from there. But so the basics of it, on June 9th, 1991, at approximately 5:08 a.m., three police officers responded to an address on 38th Avenue in reference to an injured person call. They fire personnel were retrieving the victim when the police arrived. He was unconscious. The officer spoke with Mary Lou Galvin. She said that you were her ex-boyfriend and that you let yourself into her apartment. She believed that you entered through an unlocked patio door. She explained that the two of you had planned to go to Laughlin, Nevada on that date. She lies that when you entered her bedroom and asked if she was ready to go, and you then noticed that there was another male sleeping in the same bed with her. You seemed angry and left the bedroom. After leaving the bedroom, she said that she heard slapping sounds coming from the living room. She ran to the living room and discovered the victim lying on the couch bleeding from her head. And that you had left the apartment. There's different information in the county attorney's version of it, and that is that you found the person in the bed with her, you left the apartment, came back with a metal tool, and with an intent to beat up the unknown male. When you re-entered the apartment, the victim went out from the couch where he was sleeping and struck him in the head with another tool. And you fled the scene at that time. The victim ultimately died. So is that basically what happened, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So, going from that point, and it seems that it was mentioned, I think, in trial or at least on appeal, that you had a previous fight with the victim, and with all three of you lived together for a period of time, and you had a fight with the victim, and the victim at that time had kind of beat you up, then took some money and rode off in your truck. But the point of it was is that he was had created fear within you, and that's why when he got up and you were in the apartment, that's why you hit him, because you were afraid of him, and he had beat you up before. Is that true?
Yes, sir. It was my apartment, and we let him stay with us because he lost his place. And then he got mad at me because me and Mary Lou, which was his niece, got into an argument. So him and his friends, they jumped me and beat me up, not only once but twice. And then I was forced to move out. But I was still in contact with Mary Lou, and that's when we had plans to go to Laughlin. And that morning I went to pick her up, and that's... No, that was the situation I encountered.
Okay. So, the part about there was an unknown male in bed with her was true too?
Yes, there was. Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't know.
Okay, that's why you got upset and things got out of hand?
Yes, because it was my house, everything in there, I mean, you know, I bought everything in there. He forced me out, you know, forced me to move out. And, yeah, I was afraid of him, I didn't want to get jumped, and then, you know, I was afraid he was going to beat me up again, so, you know, I hit him, not in the head, I hit him in the arm, and I tried to stop him, and then I ended up, you know, hitting him once in the head, and that's when, you know, I thought I knocked him out, and I didn't hit him after that. And then Mary Lou came out, and then I just left. I realized at that moment that there was nothing, you know, anymore between me and her, you know, even though we have two children.
Okay. I also mentioned in the pre-sentence report that it was mentioned that you were trying real hard not to reveal your criminal history back in Massachusetts and that sort of stuff. So in your criminal history, you were on probation in Massachusetts, and like I said, you went to Canada at one point, and you came back. They reinstated the probation, and then he left. And apparently, somewhere in that time period, he got in trouble for something in Rhode Island. Or it was carrying a concealed weapon, which is not really a good thing. And the main problem in Massachusetts was conspiracy to traffic controlled substances. And it was a bunch of other stuff that was apparently tied into that. So, was the probation directly involved with that, or were you on probation for something else and the conspiracy was pending?
No, the probation was for that, but that was in 87, and they gave me 2.5 years probation. And I thought when the 2.5 years was over, the probation would be over, but I never checked in with the probation officer to release me. And this happened, that was 4 years after.
Right, but when you left the state of Massachusetts without permission, your time stopped. So if you served a year of probation in Massachusetts then left the state, you still have a year to serve once you're back in Massachusetts. So even 20 years down the road, you're still on a probation absconder. So that's one of the reasons your sentences were like they were.
Yes, I didn't realize that.
Okay. Well, so you see, since you've been in there, the time out of discipline, and nothing at all since 2012, and that was Disrupt Count, which I understand is a pretty easy ticket to get. But it's commendable that you haven't had anything in the last 5, and before that it wasn't too bad. You've had very little programming, but there again, being a lifer and being a foreign citizen, it gets difficult to get programming. We do understand that. And you have no release plan, so apparently you figure that ICE is going to meet you at the door if you're released, correct?
Yes, from what my sister told me, she talked to the immigration. Anyone who has a green card and commits a dangerous felony will be automatically deported. So.
Okay. So you were here. You were here legally with a green card. You just got yourself in trouble.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
And if the board were to decide to get you ready for parole or after discharge, whether you go back to Portugal or later the state, or even more or less up to ICE, then, I mean, right now they're pretty inundated, but your understanding is that they would automatically deport you?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so you've not had any immigration hearings since you've been incarcerated?
I did have one when I was first sentenced in 92, but they didn't ask me any questions or told me what they were going to do. They just put a hold on me.
Okay, so basically, but you have had one hearing, so, okay.
Yes.
Let's see if my fellow board members have any questions at the time. Ms. Rettenhouse.
Thank you, sir. Mr. DeAlvaro, which country are you a citizen?
Portugal.
So you're a citizen of Portugal, so Canada was just, you just went there?
We moved, me, my mom, and my little brother, we moved there when I was a kid. But my mom's side of the family lives in the United States, in New England. So we were back and forth. My father's family lives on the other side, Canada.
Okay. All right, gotcha. And then, so I also noticed that 8 of your major tickets in prison were kind of around drugs, positive or refusal, all those kind of things. So were you involved using drugs while you've been in prison?
No, man. I have a enlarged prostate, and I have a medical order from 2 ERs that because I have an enlarged prostate, it makes it harder for me to, urinate.
Uh-huh.
And then, besides being nervous, it just makes it even worse. But
Well, there are several of them, though, that are not for actually positive or refusal. They're for drug possession and manufacturing. I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of those. So what was that about?
Well, I have a copy here of one of the tickets, and it says right on top, it's refusal to produce a urine sample.
Right, those are the ones. That's from 09
as the 07.
That's from 09 to 12.
Which means either you have drugs in your system or whatever, and that's why you didn't want to produce.
Okay. All right, sir. And that you've had that condition since, it looks like, dating all the way back to... The first one I see is 2001. That was drug possession and manufacturing.
It's just the way they wrote the ticket, B07, which means that, but it's just a refusal of not being able to produce.
Okay, well, that's just not what this one says. This one is drug possession and manufacturing. Okay, sir. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr.
Mr. Jonathan.
Sir. So is your family in New England and Canada?
Yes, and I have a son and a daughter up in Oregon and grandchildren.
So if you were deported back to Portugal, you have no family there, do you?
No, sir.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Mr. Jones? One thing I will say that convicted felon, if you're deported back to Portugal, you can't come back here. So, what would you do if that happened? What would you do for a support system and to be able to take care of yourself? Because you wouldn't be allowed to come back to the United States for all your family that.
My sister went there last year, and she checked into a couple of halfway houses and what my situation would be. And that's where I stayed first, and I'd be working for the church. That's my plan, what I have in mind.
Okay. Any other questions from the board? Okay, there are no other questions from the board at this time. You got three supporters here. Would you really like to address the board? Step up the podium, please, and state your name, and then tell us what you'd like to say.
Hey, my name is Janet Miller. Inmate DeAlvaro was a friend of a good friend of ours. In 2010, he sent me a prayer card because I was going through cancer. We began a friendship and corresponded over the last 10 years. He's been nothing but a complete gentleman, never asked me for anything. just support and prayers. Over the years, he's expressed his regret for what happened, and he has been repenting the time that he's been in prison. He is a true Christian and prays 6 hours a day. He wants to pay his restitution and move on with his life. He's a kind and gentle soul and has helped and supported me through many difficult issues with my health over the last 10 years. If inmate Yellowbear was fortunate enough to be paroled, he would have the support. And I know we're going to kind of go back to this since we just learned more information, but I did want to say that I actually talked to, it's getting interesting because it's like who you talk to and what ICE says, but basically I talked to the field office at 2035 North Central Avenue in Phoenix, and quote unquote, he would have to be paroled before ICE will know what to do with him. There are many factors to be considered. I also asked if inmate Oliveira wrote to them about his circumstances, and he said without a reference number, they wouldn't even know who he was. And that's a quote directly from the field office. So that's why we're all kind of confused, but what I was going to say before all the ICE stuff came up was, if he was able to stay in Arizona, that he would definitely have the support of myself, my husband, and my family. My daughter also writes to him, and you know, we found him to be a very genuine, he's a very shy man, and he's, you know, in our opinion, he's a good man. So that's what I wanted to say.
This isn't a question so much, but it is interesting you should talk to the field office. My ex-daughter-in-law was convicted of manslaughter, and she had ICE detained to Germany. She came as a legal resident, or, you know, as a legal immigrant. She never, you know, tried for citizenship, and it doesn't sound like Mr. Oliveira did either. But anyway, when she was incarcerated, her status was kind of suspended, but because of the backlog, they treated her the same as they would treat him. Mm-hmm. While she was incarcerated in Perryville, she had three immigration hearings. And one of them was they said, yeah, we're going to deport you when you're released. And the other two were, there was two that said, yes, we're going to release you, or we're going to deport you. And the third one was what they call an execution order, which means it's what they do now. And you hear about it on the news, where they'll go in front of a judge and they'll say, well, come back on this date. And they can, at that point in time, say, we're going to be deported to him. And you hear that also, that they've got deportation orders, but they run around the country for 7 years mm-hmm. because the judge has never issued that final order to say, send them away. And that's one of the, as you heard, that's the confusing issue that's coming up. And I didn't really talk to immigration until the point in time that she was actually scheduled to get released, and they knew a little bit more of, you know, about what was going on. It's just been about 2 months down in Florence at the INS facility down there, and I didn't know what went on during that time period before they actually put them on a plane and sent her away. But that's another interesting point, is they took her to the airport, gave her a ticket, put her on the airplane, and she was like everybody else, and you know, and that was their deportation, to give her a ticket and put her on an airplane. And that's pretty much how they deport a majority of them back to Latin America, South America, and everything else like that. So it's unusual circumstances. But they said, and yes, they got notification that the parole board said something, they wouldn't.
Because they would take a lot of, basically said they would take a lot of all the factors into consideration before they made a decision.
So, yes, and the other interesting thing is would they let him out the streets on parole, say, you know, while they decide what they're going to do, or would they take him into custody at the door? So that's the other issue that we don't know. And then, unfortunately, it's not like, my ex-daughter-in-law was not the committer of the crime. She allowed it to happen, type thing.
Right.
So it is definitely an interesting issue, and because we're charged with trying to assure the safety of the citizens, it makes it really tough because somebody can spend 25, 30 years in prison and go back out, especially if they don't have good support or control, and then things go bad for them. That's why we're so strict on that kind of stuff. Thank you, and thank you for supporting them.
Thank you all.
Would you, the woman, would you like to speak?
All right.
Okay.
I am Mike Miller. I am Janet's husband. I do work for the federal government, and I do, and I have talked to the ICE people, and they have basically said the same thing Honorable Neal has stated. And when the individual got his paroled, usually ICE will take them into custody to go through their process. And yes, I work right down the street from the ICE facility in Florence, and I agree with, you know, I understand the system is complicated, and I know you guys need a legal opinion, and I'm not an attorney, but I believe that this man has done everything he could in prison. I think he's been reformed. I believe that he will be a good individual when he gets back in society, and because he still has many years to go to live, and I just hopefully we could come to some kind of a positive resolution for this poor man, and to he could move on with his life. So especially I did not realize that he does have a potential prostate issue, because that could turn serious. Thank you.
What branch of the government do you work for?
I work for the Department of Interior, sir.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Okay. Yes. So I don't take this as an official position, but was it your experience in researching the matter that ICE would take custody of an inmate in that transition and going to a holding pattern in custody of ICE?
Yes, that's what the individual told me. After he got released from the state, ICE would exercise that. But again, he's just a field agent.
I know, right? That's why I said I won't take it as official. Yeah. But that's what I think, or at least that's the way I understand it, and there is some doubt as to how it really shakes out.
It sounds like Mr. Neal has gone through personally.
And my ex-daughter-in-law, she served her sentence. Wasn't parole or anything else like that. She got out a year and a half early because of truth in sentencing. But when her intake came up, ICE met her at the door. But I was told by the victim's advocate that, you know, her file showed that she had those two deportation orders and an execution order.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like that's in place there. So that's where the question comes.
Yes, sir.
But it's all good information.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So, Mr. Oliveira, the discussion, your supporters, and we're nearing the end of your hearing. So at this time, before the board goes into discussion, would I give you an opportunity to make a final statement? If there's anything else you'd like to tell us, now would be the time. So is there anything else you'd like to say, sir?
No, I wrote something down so I can share my state of mind with you, because I always forget, what to say. So if you don't mind, I'll read it from
the page. That's fine, sir.
Honorable members of the parole board, 28 years ago, I was offered a 7.5-year plea bargain for the crime of manslaughter, a class 3 felony. I was willing to accept the 7.5 years, the presumptive for that crime, but ultimately I turned it down because when it came time for me to be sentenced, the judge wanted to give me 10 years. I was young when this happened. It happened in my house, and I didn't start the fight. There was two of them, and I was afraid of being jumped again for the third time. I was just trying to stop Chris from hitting me. I never thought I would put him in a coma. I acted out of fear. I was horrified when the police told me Chris was in a coma, and I'm still horrified. But when the judge wanted to give me 10 years, I thought it was too much for what I thought was self-defense. I had a jury trial and was found guilty of reckless manslaughter, a crime that carries a presumptive of 6 years. But the prosecutor pushed for 25 to life because I was on probation when I committed this crime, something I wasn't sure of because I thought my probation was over. I know the law is the law, mandatory sentences are mandatory sentences, and that's how we're judged. I also understand that's how God judges us, the same way we judge others, and that we have to pay for our crimes, either here, on earth, or on the next world. I gave my life to God 25 years ago to serve Him and do His will, and so I accept my sentence of 25 to life, and I did not follow up on my appeal. Ever since then, I've been following God's commandments, which I take very seriously. I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't do drugs. I pray, I work, and I study, and that's what I've been doing for almost 28 years. I have studied religion, philosophy, theology, and the history of Christianity, and I have shared what I've learned with everyone who cares about the meaning for the purpose of life. And it is my plan to continue to teach Christianity in the church if or when I get out. No one other than God knows how sorry I am for what I did to Chris and for all my sins. There is a deep pain in my heart, not for me, but for Chris's family, and especially his two daughters, and for my children and loved ones. I had known Chris and his family for about 5 years when this happened. Every holiday or when somebody had a birthday party, me and Mary Lou, which is Chris's niece, and our children and his family would gather at his mother's to celebrate. And so I know they are still hurting very much, you know, because of what I did. I was part of their family. I hope they can forgive me, their hearts, so that he will not consume them and they can find peace. I pray for them every day. I cannot take back what I've done, but from the bottom of my heart, I truly am sorry. And I ask God for forgiveness every day. I was young and foolish when I committed this horrible crime. And I was stupid and naive about the law when I didn't accept the plea bargain for 10 years. I am old now, and I can barely walk or work with my hands because I have real bad arthritis. But I still have a lot to offer. I have a lot of knowledge and understanding of Christianity, God, and moral philosophy. And I ask the chance to share it with others on the outside, especially my children, grandchildren, nephews, nieces, and friends. I would like to help people live a virtuous life and help save souls. I ask you today for that chance. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. The board will be going into discussion now to make a determination. We'll be talking amongst ourselves. But we won't be addressing you, but we want you to stay on the phone. You can hear the entire conversation. And once we've made our decision, we'll get back to you. Okay, sir?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. The board is now in discussion. Well, we've got the, now I call it a quandary rather than, or a conundrum rather than a quandary. I'm impressed with Mr. Giallo's record inside prison. He overall has been fairly good in his behavior in the last 5 years. He's been more than 5 years. He's not had any tickets. I do understand that he's got two things going against him as far as getting a lot of programming. One is his lifer, and two is Farm National, which both of those make it really hard to get much programming. Although his family isn't here, he has some friends who seem to be very devoted to supporting him. I think overall, I would be in favor of a parole, but unfortunately, the ICE detainer shows the same situation that us did at the last hearing had. But we do have a little bit more information, I think, even though it's not official, you know, official information, but that it's kind of a verification of that there was a process they'll follow if he gets a parole. And if they do consider all things, I think that there's a possibility that a judge might not deport him based on everything in the family here in this country and none in the foreign country and raised here. And tell by his accent that he was raised in the Northeast. And although Portuguese is a different language than Spanish, they both have a similar accent when they speak. And it's not there, but he's got a Northeastern accent, no doubt. I would definitely be involved. If we had option of home arrest, I would be no doubt in my mind that I would support that. With the situation with ICE, I'd almost be willing to say, see gold, see what happens, but I don't think that that's the proper way to handle the situation because of our responsibility to not only to Mr. Alvarez to make sure he has an honest chance of rehabilitation, but the citizens of Arizona and the United States of America, we have that responsibility. And so I think I would like to do a denial for parole or actual discharge, but with a 6 month return instead of a year, because if we can get some information, it would make it a little easier to make decisions in this type. And I do think Mr. Oliveira's, I learned an opportunity to be returned to society and complete his rehabilitation. So, but now it's time for discussion.
I agree.
Okay. Okay, well, so based on all the information that we've had today in our discussion, I'm going to move to remove and deny Mr. John De Oliveira. You see number 092679, deny great parole and absolute discharge at this time, but I would recommend the 6 months before we return, and hopefully by that time we would have more information. So that would be my motion.
Second.
Agree.
Agree.
Motion by myself, seconded by Mr. Johnson, and agreed by Mr. Thompson, Mr. Canonis. And the reasons for denial would be it was a serious and violent offense. It was loss of human life. Trauma to the victim because it wasn't an instantaneous thing. He violated previous parole or probation. He does have a prior criminal history. Not lack of programming, that's just because of the lack of the numbers, not because of lack of his effort. And I'm not going to approve the release plan because there are too many questions in it for him to really be able to have a solid one. But it does sound like he's been investigating the possibility of halfway having the stuff in Bilgeville where he would expect to go. Unless there's something else I'd like to add to that. Okay, Mr. De Oliveira, you heard the decision and you understood our discussion, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, now I'm going to give you some information, a little bit of it, just so you understand a little better. Your supporters here were here for a previous hearing where we had the same issue of rice detainer. And there were so many questions on what would happen if we were to grant you parole as to whether you would be, you know, just released out the door into society and, you know, assigned a parole officer, whether ICE would pick you up, what kind of processes would go on. And we're going to try to get some more information so we know a little bit better about it. And the idea that I said, you know, if home arrest were available, I'd be all for it. Because you have rights detained, you're not eligible for home arrest. And so we have a lot of issues. But I hope from the discussion you understand that we're very supportive of you and the idea of getting you back out into society. We just need to figure out the process. Now, normally, because of the date of your crime, you could ask for a 1-year set-off, but we're going to do 6 months, so you should be certified in about 6 months to come back in front of us, and hopefully we'll have all the answers by then. Okay, sir?
Thank you.
Okay, and we do wish you the best of luck. Keep doing what you're doing, and just try to be safe and stay out of trouble, and we'll see you in about 6 months. Okay, sir?
I appreciate your concern. Thank you.
All right, thank you, sir. This is what you're hearing, and if you could put the CO3 back in front, please.